Welcome to the Physician Financial Success Podcast. My name is Josh Metal, and this is the podcast dedicated to advising physicians how to avoid financial landmines. Today, we'll be talking with Jason DiLorenzo from Doctors Without Quarters, a student loan advisory firm that specializes in working with medical professionals, counseling them on what to do with their consumer and student loan debt. Jason, I'm excited for our call today, and I love your slogan. I just want to start with this. The slogan is, we are tireless students of the student loan marketplace so that you don't have to be. I love that. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing well, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you spending some time with us. And I know you have a ton of knowledge to drop on young physicians who might be trying to figure out the best strategies for their student loans. So let's just jump into it. Tell us a little bit about your background and history and how you got started with Doctors Without Quarters. And where you are today. Bring us up to speed.
Sure. Yeah. I've always probably been a numbers guy from back in my studying finance days in college. Then I worked for a little while as a financial advisor, then in the financial lines of commercial insurance underwriting. In about 6 years, I became the regional director for a student loan specific advisory for graduate professionals, and I kind of quickly learned that this is an industry that deserves and needs some dedicated talent because it's ever evolving and relatively complex. And kind of focused that on doctors specifically, as I realized that early career physicians are very busy in their careers and don't have the time to get their arms around a lot of these changing programs and their repayment strategies in general as they focus on their careers. So about 6 months ago, I launched Doctors Without Quarters as a dedicated advocate to early career graduate health professionals to help them navigate the student loan environment. And that's what kind of got me here today.
I love it. I love the background. So you created Doctors Without Quarters as a standalone student loan advisory firm. Can you help us understand exactly what that means and why you think that's important to the clients you serve?
I can. So the student loan industry in general, lenders and servicers, there's a lot of conflicts of interest exist between those organizations and their borrowers. And so we've kind of, as Doctors Without Quarters, has carved out our niche in advocating borrowers to make the right decisions about their loans, which previously hadn't existed, in my view, as a dedicated service or organization. So if you think about, there's several main servicers for federal student loans at this point. They all want to service student loan business because in 2010, the federal student loan industry was nationalized and all borrowers who go to accredited schools first get their student loans from the direct loans program. And then they're serviced by these different organizations, loan servicing organizations. And so very often with your borrower and you want to get answers about repayment strategies, which doctors certainly need when they go into training. You'll often find that some of the advice can be conflicted, not in the best interest of the borrower, but rather in the best interest of the lender or the servicer. And there wasn't really an organization out there that aligned specifically with borrowers to help them make these decisions and put some case studies and analytics to it. And that's what we do. That's our corner of this sandbox, if you will, is to align with the borrower, to approach the marketplace and help them understand what their options are, and then make the best decisions regarding their loans. So I think what's unique about us is that we take a complete advocacy approach.
Well, they certainly need that. The confusion around student loans in my dealings with younger docs is substantial. And so to have somebody from an advocacy standpoint that doesn't have a dog in the fight, whether you go left or go right, they're just there to advise you, is exactly what's needed. So I applaud you for that.
Yeah, it comes up, you know, all the time. An early career physician who is still, you know, in training, but maybe 30, 32 years old, been in training for a few years, went to a long residency program, maybe did some fellowship, has a family, wants to buy a home, and has still a significant amount of student loan debt. That's almost like another mortgage. There are ways to navigate the student loan repayment environment to give yourself the liquidity and room to make, to make an informed and effective home purchase. And those are the kind of things that we help people, line up from your perspective.
Yeah, that's perfect. So that is a great segue into my next question, which is, let's talk a little bit about the differences between IBR and pay-as-you-earn. And also, if you could just comment for me, if the physician going through, let's say they're going through residency or fellowship, has the ability to make additional payments, would you recommend that they do so?
So the first part of the question is the difference between IBR and pay as you earn.
Mm-hmm, correct.
We'll start there. So they're both income driven loan repayment plans that function almost exactly the same. There are two differences. So with income based repayment, it doesn't matter when you took out your federal student loans. You're eligible for income based repayment if you can demonstrate the hardship that qualifies you for that program. And the hardship is simply 15% of your discretionary income monthly. This doesn't sound simple, but it is. 15% of your discretionary income monthly needs to be less than what you would be required to pay on your loans over a 10-year standard monthly payment term. So if we put just the average physician's economics to that, they have on average $220,000 of federal student loan debt. Over 10 years, that's going to cost about $2,400 to $2,500 per month, monthly on a 10-year standard repayment plan.
Mm-hmm.
If you're making $50,000 a year, then 15% of your discretionary income, if you're single, is probably about $350 to $400 per month.
Mm-hmm.
So that disparity, that's your hardship. And when you demonstrate that, you're eligible for income-based repayment. And it doesn't matter when you took out your loans. The pay-as-you-earn program has the same exact formula for hardship in terms of how the formula looks, but it's 10% of your discretionary income.
Hmm.
So that hardship is demonstrated on a $50,000 income at probably the $250 to $275 mark per month for the same level of borrowing. Now, with the pay-as-you-earn program, you have to be a newer borrower. You can't have any federal student loans before October 1st of 2007. So today's, like this year's medical school graduates, probably are all eligible for the pay-as-you-earn program. Now, both of these programs also have two loan forgiveness components to them. They both will forgive your loans at the end of 10 years if you're working in public service. Now, 95% of residency and fellowship programs in the U.S. are public service qualified entities because they're academic teaching hospitals that employ their house staff from their nonprofit organizations. So you're counting down this 10-year clock. Most house staff, residents and fellows are counting down this clock if they use these programs, which they probably need some relief related to their student loans anyway. So for most of the doctors that I advise, I encourage them to use these programs. And in fact, the last part of your question, I encourage them to pay the minimum in both IBR and pay as you earn. So if you had, a $250 payment in pay as you earn, but you have the liquidity to say afford paying $750 per month, I would tell you to save that additional $500 a month during residency. Put that in a non-risk generating, interest bearing sort of money market or savings account, which doesn't return much these days, but if you're in line for loan forgiveness, which most residents and fellows are with public service loan forgiveness available as it is today, you wouldn't want to compromise that savings opportunity. And in addition, the savings that you put aside, you would not subject that to risk. If you did need to go into repayment on your loans and loan forgiveness wasn't an option at the end of training, you could conceivably pay off your accrued interest or as much of it as possible on your student loans before you went into practice, and that interest wouldn't have capitalized over the course of your training. So there's not really a cost to paying additional down on your debt. I wouldn't advise people to do that when they had a loan forgiveness opportunity that would be compromised. Does that make sense?
It does. And I have a couple of questions. Man, this is good stuff. So first of all, can you just give me definition of public service? So what type of hospitals would or would not qualify for the loan forgiveness?
Great question, because this is tricky. 80% of hospitals, this is a rough number, 80% of hospitals in the country are nonprofit organizations, the hospitals themselves. However, many physicians work for physician practice groups that contract with nonprofit hospitals. So it's very possible, and it's even more probable in some specialties, that you are working in the building of a nonprofit hospital, but your employer, where your paycheck comes from, is a for-profit entity. Now, this can vary by specialty and it can vary by state, so it's hard to give a direct answer to that question. In California, where I live, the Kaiser system would be a good example of a non-public service qualified attending role. So you do your residency in the Kaiser system, and you're employed by the foundation as a resident and a fellow, and if you stay on as a hospitalist or an attending physician in the Kaiser system after you're done with training, in California, TPMG, the Permanente Medical Group, which is a for-profit physician group, is your employer, and you're no longer eligible for public service loan forgiveness.
Mm.
So that dynamic can vary amongst hospitals in different states. The federal law that kind of dictates how hospitals hire people is called Stark Law. This is a federal law that bans the practice of physician self-referral for Medicare and Medicaid patients. And some states have very strict interpretation of Stark Law, like California, which is why you see the Kaiser dynamic. Other states access some of the loopholes related to Stark Law, and they hire their physicians directly in many specialties. So if you're in one of those states, or if you're at one of those hospitals, or you want to be at one of those hospitals, it might be a higher likelihood that you would be employed directly by the hospital and such. You know, I always advise our clients as they learn where they want to be at the end of training to help them make, you know, those decisions on their loans based on the potential for loan forgiveness savings, depending upon where they land.
Yeah, I saw you do and we'll give your contact information at the end for folks that want to reach out to you. But you did a great analysis and presentation that I saw where you showed the disparity between nonprofit and profit entities compensation and the you know, newly attending physician trying to make that decision which way to go, and then how those impact the student loans. And I was quite shocked at the results, that it was better to go the lower income route and go loan forgiveness in the illustration that you gave, with even a quite substantial difference in salary between the two entities.
Correct. Yeah. So what we calculated in that case study, just to put some perspective to this, is, you know, because I don't understand why nonprofit hospitals aren't more on top of using the repayment programs that are available to their residents, like a teaching hospital, why they're not making certain or doing proactive things like certifying their employment as a public service qualified at a public service qualified entity. I don't really understand why hospitals aren't more on top of this, because in that case study, you had a borrower who had $250,000 of student loan debt, not an uncommon scenario.
Mm-hmm.
It goes up to $300,000 by the time they're done with 4 years of training. And they've been in pay-as-you-earn and paying just a few hundred dollars a month on this debt. And they got offered a faculty position at the residency hospital where they trained. And that, not just for economic reasons, but for personal reasons, that's what they wanted to do in medicine, is maybe stay in an academic setting. And maybe that salary offer was around $155,000. But then they get offered, you know, a $240,000 salary to use the example of earlier, a hospitalist at TPMG in the Kaiser system. But there's no loan forgiveness available there, whereas there is in the faculty position. So the overall out-of-pocket student loan payments, if you take the nonprofit job, the faculty position, is probably somewhere around $300,000 in reduced out-of-pocket loan payments. So what we did was take that number and factor it into what is your pre-tax salary actually worth. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more than $155,000 because on average over the next 6 years, your out-of-pocket savings on your loans is $300,000. It's $300,000 less. And so that salary became worth close to $250,000 on average for the next 6 years. Now, that's a six-year retention tool for that hospital. If they are making certain and being proactive about making sure that their residents are participating in these plans that already make the most financial sense for them, and they don't, you know, make overpayments and all of that, that we discussed earlier. So, I've done some education for hospitals as well to help them understand that there's a federal subsidy to your compensation package that exists here. If you're a nonprofit hospital employing your attendings or your faculty, you know, from your nonprofit organization.
Yeah, and that
it is.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's all right. It hasn't caught on yet. And I'm not sure why.
Well, keep fanning the flames, my friend. I think the presentation was important, and people got to have that info.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on to my next question here. You say that 95% of companies advising student loan refinancing don't have a program that will fit doctors during residency. So that seems like a big number. So talk us about what a doc should know about refinancing and give us some insights on when and why it would make sense to do so.
Sure. So the refinancing marketplace is crowded and competitive, increasingly so, I would say, you know, every day. There seems to be a new player that's getting into, I won't name companies here, but I 10 to 15 of them come off the top of my head, whereas even 6 to 8 months ago, I feel like there was only a handful. And so this is a big short-term business right now. You might even call it somewhat of an arbitrage that exists in the marketplace right now, because when you went to grad school, medical school, or any other graduate program from 2006 until today, graduate school interest rates, the federal loans, can be up to 8.5% since 2006. The lowest they were was in 2013 when the Stafford loans were available at 5.4% for 1 year. So the average graduate borrower has an interest rate probably around 6.5% or 7%. Now, those graduate borrowers who have the opportunity for higher incomes, you know, the private marketplace has realize that these are better risks and that they should offer lower interest rates. So a lot of these refinancing companies aren't even banks. They'll package the loans to investors. Now, if you're in residency, there's no return available because most residents, again, for the dynamics that we talked about earlier, can't afford to go into some, you know, repayment plan while they're still in training and have, you know, a $50,000 income and they're looking at $200,000 or $300,000 of debt. The lowest interest rates in the refinancing marketplace are going to be available when you choose the shortest repayment term. So that even makes the payments required higher. So most of these refinancing companies won't offer a residency product because they need their borrowers to go into full repayment.
Right.
Now, there are a couple that have figured out how to attract their investors or as a bank, offer a residency product where you do get a deferment for some period of time. The trick is, as we were talking about earlier, 95% of residency and fellowship programs are public service loan forgiveness qualified. And if you ask most doctors in their first year of residency or their second year of residency, they might not know where they're going to be practicing yet. Academics might at some point speak to them. They might apply for a fellowship and stay in an academic realm. They might not know what state they're going to go to know that their hospital is either going to employ from a nonprofit or a for-profit. And so while they're in training, it doesn't make sense to go off the path of public service loan forgiveness. But there are doctors who know that they're going to work in the for-profit sector. There are doctors that, to use again the Kaiser example, that know that that's where they want to be. And in that case, I might say if there's a bank out there or a lender that will refinance your loans while you're in training and rates are low right now, and you're comfortable choosing, you know, a repayment term even though you don't know what your salary is going to be as an attending yet, then there is that opportunity. But I try to make people understand the federal benefits that they're giving up. Even though the interest rates are high, the savings opportunity could be great. And it's tough to choose, you know, a repayment term that's going to get you a low interest rate when there's still some uncertainty as to how much money you're going to make when you're done with training. So I think a lot of the banks have realized, or the lenders have realized, that the resident market is tricky and haven't come down into their early career resident or early stage residents just yet. But there are a couple lenders that have. And in some cases, I would say not the majority, it does make sense for them to refinance their loan. As an example, if you're married to these income-based plans, we'll have, I don't know if you're going to ask me about taxes, but I'm throwing it out there now.
Yeah.
If you're married to someone that has a high income and you're in an income-based loan repayment plan, then your household income is going to dictate your payments. And if you're married, say, to an attending physician who's making, you know, $250,000 or $300,000 a year, you're making $50,000. Your payments go up significantly if you don't file your taxes separately. So some people might get priced out of being able to use public service loans through the misdemeanor in residency, and in that case, they might be a refinancing candidate. So I'm glad to see that the marketplace has at least a couple players that have a competitive product.
Man, there's a lot of moving pieces, and there's such a need.
Yeah.
There is such need for Doctors Without Quarters, because I get it now, right? Everybody's got their perspective that they're pitching because it behooves them. But with so many moving pieces, if you don't have somebody in the middle ground acting as an advocate, you just really can't make the right decisions there.
That's why we're here. I don't really think there's anybody else out there that does what we do as a dedicated advisor.
Yeah. So let's go to the. Go ahead. Did you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, I just realized as I'm talking through these scenarios, it does get deep and complex. And I'm doing all the talking here. I'm not giving you a chance to say, does this make sense or.
No, you're good.
It's complicated stuff.
And one thing you said that I just took a little note on, you mentioned about debt capitalizing or interest capitalizing while in the pay-as-you-earn program. So can you just comment on that? If I'm going through residency or fellowship, still in training, and I've decided to go with the lowest payments on pay-as-you-earn, is that interest capitalizing while I'm in training?
It is not capitalizing. It's accruing. It's very similar to how loans work when you're in school deferment. So when you're in medical school, your interest accrues at whatever your average interest rate. We were saying 6.5%, 7%. You know, that number adds up, but it doesn't, you know, capitalize. It doesn't get added to principal. So if you enter pay as you earn in your intern year, and a lot of interns are able to get a zero payment in pay as you earn because your payments are based on your previous year's tax return. So fourth year medical students that when they graduate, they file a tax return for the prior year. You know, that tax return can be used as income documentation. Actually, have a zero payment, which almost functions as an extension of your grace period, except it also counts down the loan forgiveness clocks that are ticking there.
Sure.
If you're in, you know, a nonprofit residency. But with respect to pay as you earn, wait. So I went on that tangent, and I lost sight of the answer to your question. What was the question?
Yeah, no problem. So where we were going with that was the difference between interest accruing or capitalizing. So I think
capitalizing.
Yeah,
you got it. So while you have the hardship that qualifies you for these programs, and as we talked about the disparity between 10% of your discretionary income and how much you would normally be required to pay on your loans, it's significant for a resident.
Yep.
While you have that hardship, the interest only accrues. It doesn't compound or capitalize.
So
that's kind of an inherent benefit that people don't always take inventory with to understand that that's a benefit. If you use forbearance, and a lot of doctors from previous years, today's doctors' predecessors, they did use. They didn't pay anything on their student loans during training. They also had variable interest rates that came down to, in the subprime mortgage crisis, That came down from 7% to 2%. So as a financial advisor, you would say, don't ever pay that down. That's practically an asset.
Yeah.
2% student loan debt. So today's borrowers have fixed interest rates on an average between 6.5% and 7%, and capitalization is expensive. So if you're using forbearance, your servicer can capitalize the interest every year. So what, you know, what starts out as a $2,500 a month monthly payment on a 10-year payment term, after paying nothing for 4 years of training, and all that interest capitalizes along the way, your payments are like $3,300 per month when you graduate from residency. So IBR and pay as you earn, you know, drop somewhere in the middle of there in terms of accruing interest. It's not as expensive as forbearance.
Wow, that is powerful, and I never understood it. And I have conversations with you know, young medical professionals all the time about student loan debt because it factors into their, you know, their mortgage qualifying. So I just want to just really park there for a second. What I'm hearing you say is, if I'm done with my training and I'm making my decision after my grace period, should I go down the path of forbearance for an additional year, or should I go pay as you earn? If I go down the path of forbearance and I have $200,000 in student loans at 6.8%, then roughly at the end of that year, I'm going to have a balance of $214,000. Then on the next year, I'm paying interest on $214,000, not on $200,000. And then the year after that, I'm paying interest on $230,000. And the year after that, I'm paying interest on $265,000. Yep. So we're compounding interest if you go route of forbearance. If you go pay as you earn, we're making these small payments, but I'm only accruing interest on $200,000, the principal, rather than the compounding.
The whole time. Yep. That's correct. That's exactly right. Those are very accurate numbers that you're spelling out there.
Buddy, nobody understands this stuff. I'm telling you, that is so important to know.
Yeah. It's, I think it makes, you know, having a little skin in the game and paying this few hundred dollars a month, I think it makes it economically mandatory.
Yep. Agreed. That's powerful. Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to pass that on to the clients I serve from now going forward. So I appreciate that.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, killer stuff. Okay, last question. So we're a young physician. We're at the end of our residency or fellowship, and now we're at the place where we're going to actually start, you know, making some money. And so now we have to really shift our repayment strategy, right? Let's say as we get through training, we just said, hey, this pay as you earn really seems to make sense. It's only 10% of my discretionary income. I'm not capitalizing or compounding the interest. This seems to be the way to go. And I may go to work for a nonprofit entity and have forgiveness. Now we get to the end of this thing. And now we're at the point of choosing going left or going right in terms of where I'm going to work. Now, what should my decisions be hinging on? What should I be taking into consideration at this point?
Yeah, well, so because that case study that we talked about earlier where your salary was worth, instead of $155,000, maybe it was worth $240,000 as a salary equivalent because of the loan savings that you get. So if you're truly looking at two job opportunities in a nonprofit and a for-profit environment, then you're going to want to do that case study analysis, the one that I walked through earlier, and determine how much less are your loans going to cost if you take the nonprofit job and put some numbers to that in terms of what's that salary actually worth for the next, you know, 10 minus X number of years that you did in training to get public service loan forgiveness. Now, if you do take the nonprofit job, I'm going to be, as your advisor, discuss with you how to keep your payments as low as possible for that next 6 years or whatever it is to total 10 years so that you get the maximum amount of loan forgiveness. Now, that becomes tricky when, you know, Obama's budget proposal for 2015 wanted to propose to cap public service loan forgiveness, not allow borrowers to file their taxes married and separately to get reduced payments, you know, if they had a higher household income. So there's some legislation that could potentially limit some of this savings that people need to know about. You know, residents are and fellows are busy, so they're not following all these legislative changes. But the past two budget proposals have targeted the expense of these programs in terms of loan forgiveness. Mm-hmm. But they've also become, some of the budget proposal items are a little more friendly to borrowers who have hardships. For example, we mentioned earlier the difference between IBR and pay-as-you-earn being when you took out your loans. There's also a proposal to eliminate the loan borrowing requirement and have everybody eligible for the pay-as-you-earn program. And we didn't talk about this, but pay-as-you-earn has a 20-year loan forgiveness component on any balance left outstanding, regardless of what sector you work in. So the government is essentially saying, if you're in loan repayment for 20 years, we're not going to saddle with you with student loan debt beyond 20 years. Now, right now, that loan forgiveness is a taxable event. So if you had, if you came out of medical school, and this is not an uncommon scenario, I counsel a lot of doctors in this scenario, they have $350,000 or $400,000 of federal student loan debt. They're in a, I don't want to target any particular specialty, but they're in a lower paying specialty. Let's say, for example, pediatrics. They're expecting maybe $140,000 or $150,000 starting salary, you know, after 3 years, or sometimes it's even 6 years of training, 3 years of fellowship. So there's 14 years left until they have potentially taxable loan forgiveness available to them. In that case, you know, we run the analytics to, for people to say, that's actually the cheapest route out of this debt. Over 20 years based on that income, you won't even, your total amount of payments won't even equal what you borrowed. So I'm going to tell that borrower to stay in pay-as-you-earn for the whole 20 years, even if they're working in a for-profit environment. And their refinancing profile probably wouldn't be as attractive due to their debt-to-income ratio to where the refinancing marketplace would even offer a solution for them. But there is a federal backstop of relief. And then the budget proposal item on Obama's 2016 budget proposal proposes to eliminate that tax liability, which would change the game for a lot of, you know, high-dollar student loan borrowers who are in maybe lower-paying specialties. So did I make this sound even more complex now?
No, I mean, my conclusion on the other end here is, you know, you really widened the prism and the perspective that I have. So I appreciate that immensely, and I know our listeners do too. But, you know, I recognize that the medical profession isn't all about money. It's about where you think you can serve and practice medicine the best and where you feel fulfilled. But this is so valuable. And this analysis is so important. I want to end on this because I think almost anybody, everybody should at the end of this student, if you have student loans and you're making this decision, you've got to have this kind of an analysis done so you can think through the long-term net application or what I mean by that is, you know, net of student loan forgiveness, net of taxes, net of salary. What does it pencil in the long term? And this analysis is vital. So how do our listeners find you and how do they get connected with you to help work on this type of an analysis for them?
Yeah, so I myself and we have a small team of sort of regional educational directors. We work with a lot of schools and hospitals to do presentations and lectures and you know, resident retreats or resident orientation. So we have some institutional relationships where we'll come to schools and hospitals and talk to graduating students, you know, or hospital house staff. So we may be coming to your neighborhood at some point, and we're available to do that for those who are interested in having this dedicated talk at their program. We also, you can just visit our website. I write a blog on some of this stuff and legislative changes. We're available for consultations, presentations, suitability analysis for the refinancing marketplace, as we were talking about. You can get all that information on our website. It's www.dwoq.com, Doctors Without Quarters, dwoq.com. And you can start there to get more information about us and where we're going to be. We have webinars that we host at different intervals, so you can sign up for a free webinar, which will cover a lot of the content that we've talked about here today. And that's our website.
Man, thanks, Jason. I really appreciate the information and your willingness to share so openly with all of our listeners. And I look forward to connecting with you soon. I just want to really thank you for the time today.
Hey, thanks for the audience as well. I this stuff is important, as you said. You know, the economics of practicing medicine are challenging sometimes, and so to do what you want to do and to serve as you want to serve, and so we help everyone figure out how to economically make what they want to do viable. And I appreciate this this opportunity or this venue.
My pleasure, buddy. Look forward to connecting with you again real soon.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.